Hello, once again. So this is our final full day. Final formal Dharma talk. And we've already been projecting to leaving since yesterday when we talked about the schedules and the rides and the airplanes and the trains and everything. And yet we're still here. So what do we do with that? This projecting ahead and yet still being here. And I'm sure everyone feels differently today than they did on Sunday. I don't know how you feel, but I'm sure it's different. At least the energy in the room is very different, and the meetings I have with you are very different. Everyone is... Everyone is, seems, the feeling I have of them is they're much more relaxed. Their faces are open. The things they say are different than what they said the first day. And I feel the same thing for myself. And maybe I can perceive that more clearly in the others because I am also more relaxed, clearer, perceiving things in a different way. Which is the fruit of sitting here minute after minute, hour after hour, day after day, sitting, being with what is, letting things arise and fall away, experiencing that impermanence. We've very clearly experienced the impermanence. We experience it all the time of day and night. The temperature outside, we've experienced the impermanence of that. It's kind of even hard to remember what it was like when it was so hot, although we didn't like it. The impermanence of even our own clothing, the food, everything is impermanent, and we've experienced that here. When you're sitting and your thoughts come and go, impermanence. We've also had this opportunity, because we're in a tight group together, to recognize on some level the interdependence of how what someone does has effect on me, and what I do has an effect on someone else. If I go, someone mentioned the shower the other day, if I go in the shower at 6:30 and I spend a long time in the shower, that has an effect on the others who are waiting to use the shower or the toilet or whatever it is. If I don't take a long shower and I just have a briefly run in and out, same thing, that has an effect. If someone suggested we just leave the door open for 10 minutes and everyone can go in and brush their teeth and whatever, that has an effect as well. Every step I take is linked to every step everyone else takes, and vice versa. So we have, in a collective group like this, we experience that in a different way than if we were just out there and on our own doing our daily lives. And so at the beginning of the week, when I mentioned something about life and practice, and life is practice, it's just different circumstances just looks, the details look different, but it's also practice. We have this, I've said this before, that each of us is given 24 hours every day. Equal. Everybody gets 24 hours. We each choose to use those 24 hours differently. Use, you know, we used, or spend, or...
Live.
What?
Live.
Live, yeah. Those 24 hours differently. So, within those 24 hours, are we going to squeeze practice and say, okay, in this 24 hours, I'm going to like squeeze a little bit of practice in there? Or are we going to build our practice so that it becomes our lives? So that we're not like trying to squeeze work into our practice or squeeze our practice into our life. Build it so that it is our life, so that it is our practice. And, you know, it might not look different from the outside. And I give my own example because it's what I know best. And my comrades, you know, a lot of my Dharma brothers and sisters. When I began practicing, I had a small child. I had a full-time job. You know, I had my life with my friends, and I was a single mother because I was separated from the father. And then when I really engaged with the practice, I then had a new partner and a second child, moved into a Zen community. But I still had the children. They still went to school. I went to the parents' meetings. We went on summer holidays to my family. We celebrated the Christmas holidays in France with the French family. I went to my job. My colleagues had no idea. Most of them had no idea I was living in a Zen community. Why should? It didn't matter, right? What mattered was how I did my work, how I lived my life, how I didn't try to squeeze practice into all of that. All of that became practice. So from the outside, it didn't really look different. Except I reduced the hours that I worked on the pretext that I could spend more time with my children. So from the outside, it looked, oh yeah, a lot of women do that, right? You know. But that meant I had less money. And so I didn't have the extravagant lives that a lot of my colleagues had, because they had much more money than me. I didn't have the same clothing that I used to have, because I didn't have enough money to buy the fancy clothes that I had, but I needed the fancy clothes to go to my job. So I didn't need all those clothes anymore. I didn't have enough money to pay a full-time babysitter, but I didn't need the full-time babysitter because I was with my kids half the time. So the choices I made, and actually my choices were made, yes, so I could be more with my family, but also so that I could, you know, adjust my focus on making it all practice. Build it, my practice, so that it could include everything. And then I could do just what I needed to do. I had enough money to live comfortably, and my partner also worked. And I had enough time that I could participate in the Zen community, maybe not as much as the people who didn't work. I had time to be with my children. I was still an active participant in their schools. And yet, it was all practice. It didn't look any different, but it was all practice. So I'm just saying this as you have these 24 hours, what do you choose to do with it? Everybody has 24 hours, and it's your choice. And the choices we make, I'm just checking my notes to see what I wanted to say here. Well, we'll get back to the choices. I don't remember what I wanted to say about it. But so yes, we said we were here on this pilgrimage into ourselves. Right at the beginning, I said something like that. Or a pilgrimage to this holy place that is me. The sacred place of me. now we're going out, we're leaving this safe container of like-minded people doing the same thing, sharing this pilgrimage each into our own soul's being. We go out. But actually, we're just taking another pilgrimage. The pilgrimage continues in a different place. And it involves not only pilgrimage to you, the holy place, but the pilgrimage to the collective holy place out there, to the others. Because this, whatever you learned here about yourselves, whatever insights, awakenings you experienced, they mean nothing if you don't go out and apply it and manifest it as a citizen, as a consumer, as a parent, as a colleague, as a human being. Because it's collective. The traditional Buddhist teachings make it seem as if it's an individual awakening, but it's collective. And what you do here is what helps you to go then participate in the collective. And so that, yeah, make these choices as a consumer. You know, what is this contributing to? More killing, more destruction, more violence, more oppression, more exploitation? Or is this contributing to less of that? Is, as a citizen, you know, am I promoting things that encourage harmony, justice, unity rather than division? Sometimes it's really easy to clear. It's really clear to see. You know, in America at the moment, we have this politician, Donald Trump, who it's so clear that it's all about division and separation. It's so obvious. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's more subtle. Political discourse can be more subtle. This is not subtle at all. So it's a really good example to look at and say, wait a minute. Does this is contributing to racism, oppression, inegalitarian, economic exploitation, all of this discourse that we hear from this person. So do I want to contribute to that? Or do I want to make other choices that contribute to harmony and oneness and unity and well-being for myself and others? The choices I'm making, are they harmful or are they contributing to less harm? So everything that you have done here, it doesn't end when you get in your car and go away. You take it with you. And you apply that then in your being. You manifest that in your being. Bernie Glassman, one of my teachers, used to say that you could see the quality and depths of someone's practice by the way that they serve. And serving can manifest in many different ways. It doesn't mean you have to go, work in a refugee camp in... Oh, I thought you were raising your hand.
No, I'm translating. Sorry. You don't have to go.
Oh, I see, okay. That's very good. So you don't have to go work, in a refugee camp in Syria or something. You don't have to... you don't even have to go feed the homeless people in your neighborhood. You could. But serving is... How do you serve life? How do you serve the goodness of life? How do you serve not killing? How do you serve the oneness of life? And that, every moment you have an opportunity. And service, that's the thing. You know, true service is selfless. Like we said the other day, it's not self-absorbed. Because when we're self-absorbed, we don't truly serve. We're actually serving this deluded sense of self, mistaken sense of self. There was this guy in Sri Lanka, maybe other people have heard of him, who, you know, I think he was a Buddhist, I'm pretty sure he was a Buddhist practitioner. And he, at the time, this was probably the 60s in Sri Lanka, the country was very impoverished, and I think there was a dictatorship or something, I don't know what it was. And so he went into the countryside, and he, maybe for his work, I don't know what he did, and he would come to these villages, and they were just destitute, and they needed help, and they were waiting for the government to give them money to install water systems and build a school. Do you know who this is I'm talking about? No? Okay. His name is Ari something, but... So he would go to these villages, and so he would say to them, don't wait for the government. Help one another. Put your resources together and help the neighbors, you know, redo their roof. Together, collectively, organize so that you can bring the water from the river that's so you can have water. Any number of initiatives. And he said, work collectively, do it together. And they started doing this. And then it was, he would encourage one village to help the other village do that. And then another village to do that. And now there are like 15,000 villages that collectively have made schools, water, electricity, healthcare, all through the, I can't remember the name of the organization, but all through this one man's realization of the non-separation of self and other, the interdependence, and how this wisdom is collective. It's not individual. It's applied, and then it takes wisdom, takes form in with the others. So that even that, that's not what we have to do, right? We could, but we just need to go and do whatever it is that is calling to us in our daily lives. Whether it's work, family, sangha, whatever it is. And so what did I say before? I'm looking at what I wanted to come back to from what we said before. And we know from the basic teachings of the Buddha that, you know, he made these four points that are called noble, right? His realization brought him to analyze the situation and say, okay, this could be helpful for people to see that, you know, the basic thing is that we all are struggling and suffering. And basically what we're struggling and suffering with is this deluded sense of self. We think of ourselves as being separate, fixed, an identity that has been put on us, how everyone else sees us, how we want to be seen. That's not who we are. But all of that is what makes us suffer, the attachment to that. First he said we suffer, then he said the cause is that, this attachment to self. And then he said, but it's possible to end that suffering, to end that attachment to self. And then he gave these, you know, his famous 8 points of this path of how to end that suffering, to get to the root of it. We always have to get to the root, and the root is that attachment to self, whether it's individual or collective. So you look at the world out there, every, you know, any problem that's happening, any violence, any injustice, any destruction, it's all coming from that basic same root of attachment to self and to the greed and the anger and the ignorance that gives rise to. when we look into our own selves and see that's what's happening for us, then that helps us to see the world. It's become so clear that that's what's the problem in the world. And there isn't... Also, the world today is, you know, this place where there's an excess of certainties. Everybody's certain of whatever their way is, their position, their political party, their nation, their town, their money, their job, their whatever. Everyone's so certain of it. There's not much space for not knowing in that, right? This not knowing that we cultivate here is the antidote to certainty. And those certainties, they're attached to the self. You know, they come with the self, the attachment to the self. The mistaken self, let's say, because it's not that of course we're sitting here right now, and we each have our individual stories and histories and ways of doing things and appearances, different manifestations of one thing, but of the same nature, but we're all different. But we have this mistaken identity that we confuse with who we truly are.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
What it seems is that this separation, it's inside. We are separating from ourselves.
Exactly.
Even when we are in goodwill receiving ourselves, this and that, it's who receives what? We're separating.
Yep. Everything is on a micro and macro level. So all the separations we're causing here, then they manifest out there too. And as long as we don't know who here, then we will struggle out there. It's not actually there or here, but that's, we use language for that. So in our study group, we had this text not long ago about, it was called No Self, No Suffering. And it was by this American, or maybe he's Canadian guy, Melvin McLeod, who was in the Shambhala community. And it was really enlightening, I think, for all of us, because he was making the point, for those of you who were in the group, maybe you remember, he was making the point, this point about collective awakening, and this is a collective path, it's not an individual path, although the traditional Buddhist teachings make it sound like it's individual. And he said that this is, for him, you know, like the Four Noble Truths are like the most, the ultimate self-help method, but also the ultimate help method for humanity, if we could apply it to the greater world. So, but if we have to start here for ourselves, and it's not helping selfing this self, exactly, this little self, it's helping us to let go of that little self or something. It's like my husband, who's a psychotherapist, says, you know, people confuse this Buddhist practice. They think it's a practice of personal development. And this is a French term, too, you know, développement personnel. I don't know if in Portuguese you say something like that.
Yeah.
And he said, no, it's actually, what people don't realize, it's about impersonal development. Which is true. We're trying to wake up to what is impersonal, which means it's intimately personal, because it's, we each know it intimately, and yet we share it. That's what the ritual does when we chant together, and I keep forgetting to remind us to, when we chant, the point is not to like chant really loud and have our voice heard, it's to all chant as one. So no one's voice is heard over the others, except maybe the Eno, because we need somebody to follow. But even that, the Eno is not doing that so that everybody sees what a wonderful voice she has. Too bad. Failed. So that's what ritual is. Ritual gives us access to, we put away all our personal stuff, we let it go, and we participate in this ritual that allows us each to experience the unity, what is impersonal in each of us. We all do the same thing. Orioki is that. We all do the same thing. Trying to put aside our personal stuff when we do it. And so this is not only a Buddhist path that, you know, the Buddha laid out for us. In fact, when he laid it out, it wasn't Buddhist, right? It only became Buddhist after that. Or like as someone said, I think it was Alan Watts who said, Jesus did not become the man that he was by making Jesus Christ his personal savior. You know, we're asked to be, Jesus is my savior, you know. But that's not how it worked, right? After the fact, we all then make something out of it. Alan Watts is really good for that kind of thing, you know. Because he was a, you know, Episcopalian minister at one point, Alan Watts. Yeah. What? Episcopalian minister. Episcopalian is the Church of England. It's like when Henry VIII broke with the Catholic Church.
It's a Protestant church.
Isn't it? Yeah, it's Protestant, but it's like almost Catholic. I mean, it's, you know, it's not Catholic, but...
Yeah. It's definitely not Catholic.
No. But it's not like the, you know, Presbyterians or the Lutherans or something.
No, you guys are more used to the liberal Protestants.
In any case, that's Alan Watts is also that. So he knows all this Christian material from the inside. And he's also the one who, I've told this before, about Immaculate Conception. Do you have this in Portuguese, the Immaculate Conception? Same thing, same word. Yeah. And so he said, for him, Immaculate Conception is actually... what the meaning for him, and he thinks that's what the original Christian thing is too, is to be free of concepts.
Conception.
This is heretic stuff, right? Immaculate means not stained by concept, right? Which allows us to then experience things as they are when we are immaculately non-conceptual or something. Which frees us from our suffering too, because a lot of our suffering, and when I use the word suffering, I'm not like talking about, you know, deep agony or something. It's just this general dis-ease or discomfort we have, or dissatisfaction with how we are, what's happening in our lives, or... it can be something extreme, but it can also be just this basic thing of, you know, I'm not really satisfied. The first time I saw it, when I realized what I didn't realize until after that's what I was seeing, but the first time I really perceived it was when on a commuter train, and I've told this story too, between Milton Keynes and London. Milton Keynes is this place in England that's kind of,
it's enough to give you depression.
Exactly. That's
it's totally man-made too. Even the legs are fake and everything.
Yep. This was like a commuter train on a Tuesday morning, after a bank holiday, between Milton Keynes and London.
Oh, God.
And yeah, and it was packed. But we got on early. I think we got on in Milton Keynes, my comrades and I. We were coming from a retreat, so we were like, you know, like we are now. And we're sitting there in one of those things, you know, you have four people, and everyone else is standing in the aisles and hanging on and ties and, you know, like going to work after a bank holiday. And I just, we were having a great time, and I looked up and I saw all these people, and I had this impression that everybody was uncomfortable. As if it was this kind of palpable discomfort that it was like their clothes didn't fit right, or there was a tag on the back that was itchy, you know, that kind of discomfort, you know. And I was so touched by it that I couldn't look at it. I went back to my friends and we giggled and laughed and continued our joking and everything, and got off the train and took the train to Heathrow and went on my way. Only after did I realize that that was the first time I had ever really experienced this disease, this discomfort that the Buddha's talking about on a you know, universal scale. These people, their clothes fit fine. Of course, they were unhappy because it was Monday, it was Tuesday after a bank holiday on a commuter train coming from Milton Keynes. But it was much more than that. And much less. It was really this basic thing that was going on. And because it was, I sensed that on some level, I couldn't look at it. You know, I didn't want to, which is what we do. We turn away. Whether we turn away in ourselves, and so then we eat a box of candy, or we turn on Netflix, or we go out to dancing, or we go out to the bar, or whatever we do. You know, or we build walls around us so we don't see it. But it stays with us because it's in us. It's ours too. Yeah.
I didn't call my mother for 2 days because I had other things to take account with my daughter. But today morning I did call her, and I don't know if it's just the fact that when you live with someone in the same house, you know the tone of the voice, something. And I noticed, oh, everything's evolved very quickly. Are you all right? Yes, I am. Dogs are all right. Yes, whatever. I'm seeing everything. But the tone was not her tone feeling good. And somehow I keep the conversation, and at that point I ask, what is wrong, mother? Is something wrong? Oh, no. Yes, something is wrong. A bee bit me.
Stung.
And I am allergic now, so the voice can finally be preoccupied, you know. Oh, and everything went right. But this is preoccupation. And we can
absolutely
see it at every moment. Here. Yeah.
Exactly. And you could, you know, maybe you could even hear it more clearly because you had been here for doing this for hours and hours. And also you had not been with her for those, you hadn't talked to her for 2 days. But even so, you know, yeah, absolutely. And it's that kind of thing. Yep. And sometimes, when, you know, we notice it, but we don't. You know, we can tell something's wrong, but we just paper over it, or we think it's not our business, or we don't really want to know, so we go on, or it's so fast that we don't even pay attention. No.
One question. But if you don't ignore it to some point, doesn't it make all the weight of the world on your shoulders?
You mean
there
if you
needs to be a balance.
You mean if you're like focused on the all this misery of the world or something? Yeah.
Yeah, if you don't distract yourself at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is like what I said about the bodhisattva. It's not that the bodhisattva no longer cares about him or herself. It's that it's no longer just myself. So, of course, we have to take care of ourselves. And when we truly see the true nature of who we are, then there's no weight. We can see the suffering. I mean, we're fully aware of any number of suffering. I even, like, during the night, thought that dog that was barking all night was suffering. Mm-hmm. But then Lisa said to me, well, did it sound like it was suffering? And I thought, well, maybe not. Maybe I'm projecting, you know. But I thought, if this dog is barking all night, there's something going on, right? You know? And yet, I didn't have to get up and worry about it, but I noticed it. And when I could do something, you know, if I was there and it was my dog or something, I could do something, well, then I do. But there are things that we can acknowledge the suffering without having to act on it and take it on as me or something, as my load. Because then that doesn't benefit anybody. You know, doesn't benefit you. And it's not helping the people who are suffering either, because you can't do anything. We think we can't do anything. But everything has, every action has a consequence. So everything we do does affect everything else. Maybe not in the way we think. You know, if we know that if we refrain from using toxic chemicals in our house, that will then have an effect on the water supply. At least our, you know, the environment. At least we will be doing our part, because that's all we can really do. You know? But if everybody does their part, then that changes everything. Like these villagers who help each other. Or we give the image of the little bird who, there's a forest fire and the little bird comes and drops bits of water. Well, it won't stop the forest fire, but it will contribute to it, to the stopping of it. And if other birds do that, then that affects it as well. Or the image we give of the child walking on the beach that it, on which a bunch of starfish have washed up, and the tide has gone out, so the starfish are stranded. And the child has a little bucket and is walking along and putting 3 or 4 starfish in the bucket, carrying them and putting them in the water, saving them, right? And an adult comes along, and the child goes back and does that again, and an adult, of course, who knows everything, comes along and says, what are you doing? You know, and she explains, and he said, oh, that's very sweet, but you know, you can't save all of them. And she says, yeah, but for the ones that I do, it makes all the difference in the world. Mm-hmm. So it really makes a difference whatever you do with your 24 hours. You will not stop the war in Gaza. You might. You know?
Who knows?
Exactly. You know, if people do collective actions, boycott, or, you know, I'm not promoting any of these things, but, you know, there are collective things that do happen. You know, the apartheid was ended in South Africa through mainly because of collective action on individual basis. And then those individual basis, that has an effect on local levels, and then local levels on national levels, and then national levels on international levels, and things change.
So it's also a follow-up in a way of what you were saying, but maybe I misunderstood or understood something else in your question, but sometimes, so I have the feeling in my own life that I go through a very full day of doing all sorts of things, whatever, and I feel sort of overloaded at moments, and so then, so this is what you mentioned in a way, and then, you know, I think for the last, or for this half hour, or for this last hour or something before I go to bed, I could read a Zen book, I could, yeah, but come on, I need a break, and reading a Zen book is, anyway. Or I could do something that would be taking care of myself, but I know, you know, sometimes I decide to do something that is a sort of mind wash thing, like disconnection, you know, so the Netflix type thing. And you know, I'm smart enough to work my way around it and think I'll do a sort of thing that doesn't make that much sense, but I'll choose a good show that sort of makes sense. You know, like this is not a complete waste of time. But these are all arrangements with myself. So I'm just thinking from what you were saying, if I understand correctly. This means that all that I'm overloading myself because I'm not functioning quite properly the rest of the day. Because if I was, I would not really feel that, or to put it another way, I suppose maybe it's, yeah, I'm, because a lot of the stuff I do during the day is work for other people, etc. So maybe I'm not entirely doing this in a completely selfless way, because I'm also doing it for the salary, for this, for that. I work on a farm, so I also get free vegetables that I can eat, etc. So what are your thoughts on that, and how can we? Well, I mean, how can we? I don't know what. Any thoughts about this thing of feeling overloaded and needing to switch off, or wanting to switch off, or taking a break.
And so, you know, if you are in contact with what you feel and what you need, then trust that you need that moment. You know, you need that. Even this notion of, it has to be like something intelligent, or I don't know what, but I don't know. You know, like everybody knows, I'm a sports fan, so like my turning off is watching a tennis match, or, you know, watching Champions League, or watching the Olympics or something. Does it have to be like, you know, or it could be going to the movies, you know, I don't know. Watching a series, you know. Yeah. Sopranos is fantastic, switching off, and yet, wow, it's one of the most amazing series in the history of television. But
so, I recommend The Gentlemen.
What?
Gentlemen. It's
a series. Oh, it's a series called Gentlemen?
Okay. What did you say?
Don't know that.
Did you say France? No, what did you say? The series with number
Sopranos.
Any other recommendations?
The Wire. The Wire, yeah.
The Wire?
The Wire.
Very old. Very old.
Very old.
Anyway,
there is another thing with that. We do have to trust when we feel like we need to do something, but something you can definitely not put trust in is the systems that want to encourage us to do those things too.
Exactly.
So there's like I think we get to know our own feelings of when we go, no, I'd actually quite like to engage with this thing and watch it and actually give it my attention. But then there's this other kind of slightly more deluded version where you say, Yeah, I definitely would like to watch that. Whereas actually what you'd like to do is kind of become a mutant zombie and just sort of like not be alive anymore for a moment. And I think it's a case of not, excuse my French, bullshitting yourself to say, yes, no, I'd really like to watch this, when actually what you want to do is not exist for a while. Like, and you know when you're doing that to some extent. So it's like getting familiar with, and the thing that you're in front of, that you're facing, the internet or whatever it is designed to make you feel like you're doing something good for yourself, even though we all know most of the time it's not doing us any good at all. Yeah. So anyway, it's just something else to be familiar with.
There is also, during the moment we see those things, apart this self funny thing for us, I really enjoy to imagine those people doing that and how great they are doing this.
Which,
when they are acting.
Oh, yes.
The
actors.
Well, that would be really engaging.
Yeah.
Wow.
But, you know, the story that Richard Gere tells when the Dalai Lama is his teacher, right? And so when he was, you know, kind of starting out, and he had a meeting with the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama said, oh, so, you know, you're an actor, huh? And he said, yeah. And he said, so what is that about, you know? And he said, well, I approach it in such a way that I really try to become these characters and really take on the emotions and what's driving them and all of that. And the Dalai Lama laughed, as he tends to do, you know, and he said, you know, so you're trying to pretend to be something that doesn't exist anyway? Something to that effect. But the idea of, yes, there's a place and a time for everything, so, and I don't know, when you say about being overloaded, it's not so much the woes of the world, like Inesh was talking about, but it's like just, you know, overload of all the stuff you have to do. We need to, you know, otherwise we will drive ourselves into the ground and burn out. So yes, of course we do need to relax. And But you could also, and you could also look at, okay, so maybe am I overdoing it? Am I doing too much? I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know. Or there's moments when we do have to do a lot, and then there's moments when maybe we're addicted to that, or we're not seeing it clearly, and we're doing too much. And
there's a great quote on the back of my red sleep shirt.
What is it again? You mentioned it the other day, huh?
It's not what you do, it's what you stop doing that matters.
Patricia?
I was wondering the way you use Netflix or it's this disconnect. It's to me, it's not really a disconnection. You are not connected at all when you move in that direction of disconnection, in a way that this authentic, what drives to see Netflix or something, it's to create relationship with something, in a way of experience life. And, we are social beings. So we live in a very lonely, we don't have a tribe or community going on. So we move, we are already in stress all day, of course, working on this or that. So if you do, if you create stress, you always need the disconnection in the way of the other. And this, the practice is that connection with life itself. So if practice is present, it can be present with Netflix also.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I think what, you know, like what... when Rory was saying, you know, it's that these kinds of things are trying to cultivate something that maybe isn't healthy. It doesn't have to be, though.
No.
You know? It depends how we do it. Someone who lived with Bernie Glassman for a while told me that she was stunned because at night, his favorite thing was to go with a glass of ice cream in his bed and watch the television. And I mean, this was a great, you know, one of the most realized people I've ever had in my life, and did amazing things for the collective, and yet, okay, and he loved pizza, beer, cigars, and he walked around with a clown's nose on, you know, sometimes. So it depends how we do it. Exactly.
For me, this thing of Netflix and stuff, basically, for more the problem that I have, for instance, when I first got a mobile phone. Before there was no mobile phone, I didn't go to reach the phone in case someone would call. You know, I would only go and reach the phone when it called. Mm. But I noticed when I first got a mobile phone,
smart,
yeah, that I would go for it even though it didn't do anything. Mm. And then I would stop myself. But now I don't stop myself, and I just go and I look on WhatsApp just in case a message. And then I turn, and then I don't read the messages, and then I turn it off, and then I. So it was, for me, the more the thing he was saying, more the thing of just at the end of the day sitting down and automatically just turning on the TV or doing something automatically, being taken, or now with artificial intelligence, but then you're getting adverts and all this sort of stuff, and then suddenly you're like, without realizing you're there, and then you're like, oh, I'm here, why am I there? So for me, that's more the difficult thing of being aware that I'm being taken somewhere that I'm not
doing
my choice.
Well, and the thing is, it's interesting that you bring up the word choice, because that's what I was thinking. We always have a choice. No one can take us anywhere we don't want to go.
Unless you're kidnapped or something.
Yeah. Of course, yes, in a situation like that, but that's not what we're talking about.
Well, it kind of is. Our mind is being kidnapped
yes,
by this.
But
so we have a choice, but the choice becomes smaller and smaller and smaller when there's something with such power that knows us better than our circuitry better than maybe we know it.
So nothing knows me better than I do.
Touché.
No, it's true. There's machines, there's circuitry, there, you know, whatever you want to say, but if you truly know who this is,
But I'm saying that if you're trying to develop a relationship with what is real, this thing will try its damn best to make you not do so.
Sure.
And so, you know, it's like saying, I can have a mindful relationship with heroin. Well, of course you can. Of course you can. Heroin could be fantastic, but you get too into it and it's quite difficult to stop, you know. And we know very well that these systems are more addictive than cocaine, you know, like, you know, they're very powerful. So it's also about being honest with yourself, how strong you are at standing up to something so, so powerful that we don't...
But see, the thing is that, okay, these what we're all talking, you know, I think we all know what we're talking about, so we don't have to go into, like, Netflix, artificial intelligence, whatever, internet, Facebook, whatever. All of that is created by the deluded mind to perpetuate delusion, right? Yeah. But so if we free ourselves from that deluded mind, we cannot become a victim of that. You know, we're free. We can participate, maybe, you know, like come home and watch a film or something. Maybe we'd say, well, I don't want to participate in that. I don't know. You know, but we have the choice. Because it's the same mind that is deluded is the mind that wakes up. And we can use that mind to cultivate awakening, harmony, unity, like I said, being, you know, integrity, or we can cultivate it to promote more delusion and division and separation. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm connecting what Adrian had said earlier and what you said of how we do things, maybe. I'm thinking many times we have the need of these things because maybe what we are doing daily, our job or whatever we are doing, we are not enough. We are too much worried about what we are doing and not how we are doing it. Like we want to do great things or we want to achieve this or that, but maybe not enough paying attention on how we are doing
that. Absolutely. Yep. And so all of this comes back to, okay, so here we've been not so much involved in what, but how, you know, in a sense. Of course it is what, but... You know, eating an Oreoki is, okay, we're eating. We're not trying to eat in some extraordinary way or something. It's how are we doing it, you know? How what's our attention? What are we bringing to it? When we're sitting here on our cushion, it's we're trying to cultivate this presence, awareness. And then when we go out of here, we can bring that and make more enlightened choices, maybe. Doesn't mean that, you know, you won't come home from work and chill, you know, with whatever you're doing. The question is, again, it's like with all the, you know, the line is it harmful or not? Is it beneficial or not? Is it, and if it's beneficial for me, usually it's beneficial for others as well, because we are one. That's what I think the Buddha or someone called it, the two benefits, that what's beneficial for you is beneficial for the other. When we're acting from a selfless place. Mm-hmm. Something like that.
And the choices,
talking about overloading and so on, your life full of things, it is important to know how you do it, but it's also important to know why you do it. Why did I choose to take this, to meet this person? Why did I choose to invite the other one? Why did I choose to go here or there? Because I realize that sometimes it has so much to do with my ego, with wanting to be seen, wanting to be liked, wanting to be appreciated, and so on. So for me, the question of why is very important too. The motivation.
Okay. What's your intention? Yeah. Yep, absolutely.
It's
some time ago there was a study. This is about the effect of our actions, not just our actions physically. There was a study I think it was a small village, of a group of people who joined themselves together to practice this practice of opening to love and kindness, loving kindness. And after some time, they saw that the criminality and all that stuff.
It's clear, huh? Mm-hmm.
You can realize that even in your own life, in traffic, for instance, when people are in the line and there's these ones that want to go in and there's a lot of cars, normally nobody gives place. Normally I do. When I give place, someone goes, and I go. And the person behind you gives place too. Mm-hmm. When someone starts doing it, the other people will follow. Sometimes it's me the first one, sometimes it's not. I always do it. And I realize, and then I look back, and I say, yeah, they did it too. So sometimes it's just small things in our lives, and yes, the goodness you do will pass on. Someone else will see it and say, yeah, I should do that too. They do it.
So keep that in mind when we go out of here, right?
Ripples.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything you say and do has effect. And so can you bring this wonderful, whatever you've experienced here, maybe you don't think it's wonderful, but whatever you've experienced, and doesn't mean preach, but just bring that into your life. And instead of trying to squeeze it into your life, you know, build your life so that that is your life. Because it already is, but we've, like, you know, strayed from that. So I think it's probably almost...
It's not even 9:17 past.
Okay. And so, yeah. Just to... You know, maybe this didn't... Maybe we got lost in the meanders of, you know, of the deluded mind, because that's what we were talking about, right? Of delusion. But it's always right here. So, you know, this path, we sit sometimes in, we say in Zen, it's immediate. And even within Zen, there's the immediate way of awakening and there's the gradual way. And we say, you know, Tibetan Buddhism, it's more gradual. In Zen, it's now. If we can close that gap and not separate it, it's both. So it's immediate. It's always here and now. We always awake here and now. We always act here and now. There's no other place we can act or respond or wake up. It's a here and now. At the same time, it's gradual in the sense that it's what we do carries over into other moments, to other people. We have new insights. We continue our practice to help cultivate that. Whatever has been realized. So it's both immediate and gradual, and yet it's neither in the Zen way. No. It's both. So it's both. And what you're looking for is always right here, in the middle of your busy life. You know, there's that, I think it's a Hindu story of some person who says they want to meditate in order to meet Krishna. And they're going to sit there until they meet Krishna. And Krishna hears about this, and so comes up behind him and taps him on the shoulder, and the meditator says, "Go away, I'm trying to find Krishna." You know, so it's always right here. But you're looking for something else. In the middle of your busy lives. It's always right here. Okay, maybe we should stop. Do a fast kinhin so that people can go to the toilet and do whatever they want to do before until the food arrives. Okay?
Four bells? Do we sing?
Oh, yes. Sorry, four bells. Getting ahead of myself.
Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I